Welcome, folks, to the Slowpokes podcast. We play great games just a little bit late. I am Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
And today we are playing the final unplayed game from one of my favorite devs, who is Mike Bithell. And yes. Today's game is Volume.
Yes, yeah. It is the, I think, final for both of us as well. We've both played Thomas Was Alone, and we've also both played Subsurface Circular.
Yep. So this is the final in the three major games, at least the ones that I'm aware of. I don't think he's made anything else. His Wikipedia page mainly talks about Volume and Thomas Was Alone. It barely mentions Subsurface Circular at all.
Yeah, actually, the only time it does is to mention that that's what he's going to call his bitlets. Like
his Bithell shorts.
Bithell shorts. So, yeah. And I think he's planning on doing some more shorter games just to get some story ideas and stuff out there.
Yeah, which is good for a couple of reasons. We'll get to that in a second. So
foreshadowing.
Volume was released in August 2015. Mm-hmm. It is a stealth game.
Yes, it is.
I was trying to figure out what, because you know how we just basically append seven or eight words on the end of genres now.
World stealth RPG
drama. Yeah, but no, this is
vampire
just
vampire novel.
Yeah, roguelike. But this is just a stealth game. This is just a stealth game.
See,
and just sounds. There's a plane.
There's a plane, David. We're actually under a flight path.
All right, we might wait for this.
What's that, Montgomery? Do you see that house down there? I bet some boys are listening to our podcast. Maybe they're making one.
Aye, Cap'n.
Oh, you are so game.
Oh, the propellers are spinning.
It's all staying in.
Wind. There's wind as well, Captain of the...
Yes, that's what
the plane. The plane with the two sets of wings.
The wind propellers.
Up and down, and I'm probably sitting in the front, I think. If you're the pilot, you're maybe in the back part of it.
I don't know how planes work. Can we not talk about planes anymore?
Is it a biplane?
Yeah, biplane was the word you're looking for.
Yeah. It's
in
a plane
this week's,
that
what plane
doesn't
did David
really have
mean?
A strong preference for one gender over the other.
Oh, you got to the joke before I could.
So yeah, this is just a stealth game, and I don't mean just to be diminishing in any kind of way. It's just that's the genre it is. You do stealth in this one.
See, I thought this was actually going to be a roguelike. As well as a stealth game.
See, and you said that last week. You said like, oh yeah, this is like Mike Bithell's stealth roguelike. And I was stuck at that moment where I was like, do you not know what the game is, or do you not know what the word roguelike means?
Because
I honestly didn't know which one it was, but we were on air and I didn't want to bully you.
With Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis, you never know if he's an idiot or just misinformed.
Though there is a distinction there, and I think it's important we appreciate it.
Yeah, and then I also embody both of them.
Because I also knew it wasn't procedurally generated either. I knew
it's
it was
not,
a series.
Yeah.
It had a story of some sort in it. I didn't know whether or not there was going to be user-generated levels, but I wasn't really surprised when I found that out. But yeah, when you said the word roguelike, it raised a single eyebrow at that point.
And it wasn't noticeable either. I didn't see that eyebrow raised.
Yeah, until just now.
Actually, until I started playing the game and I was like, this is clearly not a roguelike. I was wrong. I was misinformed.
Yeah, so I wasn't expecting a roguelike. I didn't have too much of a solid expectation. I was just kind of going in on good faith because I like the dev and the team that accompanies the name Bithell. Obviously, he's not the sole person responsible for games like
this. Yeah, he has many clones that do the work for him.
It's a 15-person team is what I'm getting at. And it's a little bit weird that, you know, we auteur people, I think.
It happens, especially when you got a catchy name like Mike Bithell.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And I'm not sure, did he do Thomas Was Alone by himself?
That was like a 4 or 5-person team, I think. A lot of the kernel of the game, the core of the game, he is involved in, so he does coding and the writing and a couple of other big things that you would think of being like the core spirit of the game.
Yeah.
And other stuff that's, without wanting to sound dismissive, all work in a game is important. Stuff that is perhaps a little bit easier to outsource, like composing and that kind of stuff, where you don't necessarily need to have as central an idea of what it is you're making. A lot of that stuff gets contracted.
Two experts,
Two experts. I mean, the composer of this is the same composer of Thomas Was Alone, as one example. One of the voice actors that you mentioned.
Yes, that is Danny Wallace, because I wrote it down.
Danny Wallace, yes. The sole voice in Thomas Was Alone is one of the main characters in this.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of people come back, and obviously Mike Bithell.
Yes, because
he's involved in this one too.
Yeah, you say that, and we talk a lot about him, but there's going to be a lot of talk about Mike Bithell because, to be honest, that's why I came to this ride.
And I was saying the exact same thing, that like I didn't have any specific expectations of this game other than it'll probably be good because of the team.
Yeah.
I knew it was kind of stealth-based. I knew it was kind of colorful. I imagined music would play a relatively significant role because it's called Volume.
Yeah. Also, you know, there would be good dialogue in it.
Like good written dialogue, if nothing else.
Yeah, for some reason, I had lumped this in together with other kind of stealth games, but it is really pure in its stealth, especially in terms of like the genre of the game, because rather than having loot drops and all that kind of stuff that a roguelike, you know, comes with it that I was expecting.
That progression kind of thing.
It was just, to me, sort of focused on the stealth.
One of the things I found out about this game after finishing it was that it was inspired in a number of different areas by Metal Gear Solid 2. I didn't know that before I went into it, and even if I did, it would have made no difference. I've never played any of the Metal Gears other than the one we've done for the show.
Yeah, Metal Gear Solid 2 is actually the one I've played the most of. So after you told me that, my brain did that
thing. That slap on the forehead where you're like, how did I not notice?
The camera moved forwards as it zoomed and did that cool effect where all the attention
it's
was
called a dolly zoom, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, call a dolly zoom on me because I was like, oh yeah, the crouching, the way you hug walls, the way you make sounds. That's very Metal Gear Solid 2.
Apparently, even like the basic animations of how you walk and stuff is vaguely reminiscent of that.
Very, yeah.
I wouldn't know, right?
I was watching him walk around. I'm like, why is he walking around like such a weirdo?
Yeah, because it is such a specific stealth crouch animation that looks quite dated. And I noticed it and I was like, I mean, I don't dislike it, but it is a little bit...
And in fact, the visuals themselves... If you're talking about Metal Gear Solid 2, it had a whole extended part with like a VR section and stuff like that, where you'd play missions in obviously computer-generated environments.
Oh, right.
Against like the same guard and stuff like that. There was even one mission where the guard was the size of Godzilla, but it was still a stealth mission. That game got really weird. Metal Gear Solid 2 got really weird.
They're all weird. They're all at least 30% weird.
Definitely. Yes, yes. One is 30%, and then they get weirder as they go along.
So, for those of you who don't really know the premise of Volume, the entire game does take place in a virtual reality environment. The basic core story is that you play Rob Loxley.
Oh!
And I don't know if it's a pseudonym or not. I think it's not.
It's his name. Yes.
Yeah. I think it is his name, but we don't want to ruin that kind of stuff. Basically, Rob Loxley in the not too distant future
of England
is protesting the
tyranny of the corrupt,
the sort of the corporate aristocracy of a dystopian future England, where this corporation led by
Guy Gisborne. It's the Gisborne Corporation.
Yep. And he's basically the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. Okay, let's just cut to the chase. Right. It's Robin Hood.
It's Robin Hood.
Right. The story's Robin Hood. There's Friar Tuck. Right. This is what it is.
This is what it is. Right. All super, super on the nose. It's not supposed to be subtle at all.
If you're an idiot, you won't catch it straight away, but it becomes clear.
Yeah. Even idiots will get it about 15 seconds in.
Yep.
So you're Rob Loxley, and the way that he's robbing from the rich and giving to the poor and all of that kind of thing is by basically streaming himself playing a virtual reality video game where he gets the layouts of these different installations for the corrupt government and does speed runs of him stealing shit, streams it on the dark web, and then real people follow in his footsteps to actually steal the real stuff.
There's something that I find really beautiful about this premise.
Yeah, it's fun, right? Yeah,
the idea of someone who's like, what's my skill set? Computers, hacking, video games. How can I help overthrow a government? And apparently the answer is streaming.
Twitch. Yeah, Twitch is the answer.
Yeah, the answer is Twitch streaming.
The answer is future Twitch.
Yeah, and basically it lays out this 3D, I think it's 32 meters by 32 meter grid environment.
It's 31 by 31, but that's fine. You don't have to listen to what's being said or written in the game.
God, so sharp, David. You're so sharp. I'm just a gentle boy. Leave me alone. Well, not even a boy. Anyway, the game is represented in this holographic grid that you move through, and everything's pretty much displayed that way, and that's how you interact with this.
Yeah, so the game has this very striking aesthetic where it's really strong colors. Obviously, everything is in 3D, but very low-res polygons, very simple colors. The AI who renders the environment brags that he can display up to 16,000 colors, which is, you know, ever so impressive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But because it's sort of like a holographic environment, you can see on the edges of the map in the places you can't walk, the warehouse that it's being displayed in, and that's all actually relatively high. high fidelity 3D models. Yes. So it's, and it's very obvious that you're in this lo-fi virtual reality environment.
Yeah, the character pops right out because he is rendered in such quality.
Yeah, he is a person and all of the guards are sort of these like vague collections of polygons. Yeah, and
they
and kind
of look like knights and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a fun premise and it's a very good look. Now, the word volume, you know, obviously refers to sound because it's a stealth game. You want to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Refers to the music. The space that you're in, this virtual reality environment, those are in the world called volumes. And so however many years ago when this corporation decided to throw a coup and install itself as the ruling entity in England, it used these volumes to train up guards and assassins and things like that. And now you're repurposing it. So there's the world that this takes place in. And that's on paper, on the back of the box. That's super interesting, I think.
Definitely. Not only just in like the terms of what it says about the characters, the idea of, you know, you don't go around murdering people. You're around assassinating things. You're stealing from the rich. It's about repurposing wealth. And that's the focus of overthrowing this kind of regime. That's a very uncommon.
A very explicitly commercial regime as well.
Yeah, that's kind of very uncommon for video games and overthrowing evil governments. I think the character laughs at the idea of using guns or being involved with them at all.
Yeah, so like I was saying, the volume was originally used to train guards and you've stolen... Rob has stolen an AI
named
Alan for that purpose, for training soldiers. And he's using it instead to be a stealthy, sneaky thief type. And so at the start, when Alan boots up, he's like, which of my cool guns do you want to use? I have so many cool guns. How do you want to learn to murder? And he's like, no guns, please.
Yes.
No guns, Alan.
And it's also an indirect one as well. Like, he is instructing people on how to rob these places. Mm. And the game world, you know, as he uploads a video, basically momentarily someone watches it and goes and does the crime.
Yeah, it's all pretty quick. You say it's indirect, and obviously that's true. He's not directly robbing any of these houses. But there is also a more direct element to the traditional Robin Hood story, because he doesn't have to give the money to anyone. The poor people just stole it in the first place.
He never even takes it. You know, I think it's a more ethical way of highway robbery.
He's definitely complicit. Like, he's definitely, at the very least, an accomplice to the crime.
But it's definitely what we would call a cool crime.
Yeah, it's a very cool crime. Play video games and get other people to steal shit. That's fun.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, though, I mean, we've talked about the premise, we've talked about our expectations. Without wanting to get too heavy, how'd you feel about the game as a whole after having played it?
That's the ticket, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the ticket.
That's the ticket. I found some of the puzzles to be very interesting, but it wasn't always heart racing.
I basically agree. I think we had the same reaction.
I was really fluctuating between this enjoyment, but not really being overwhelmed with drama, especially because it's micro runs too. I'm kind of waffling everywhere because it's like, for me, it's a bit weird.
It's fun, it's engaging, and it works.
Yes.
It is a solid game.
But
I think that the expectation that both of us kind of walked into this is the expectation that was created by a game like Thomas Was Alone or Subsurface Circular, which are both very heavily narrative and emotionally engaging games. This is far more so a gameplay-focused experience, and I think that if you're expecting really solid gameplay like you get in Thomas Was Alone and a very moving narrative side of things like you get in Thomas Was Alone, you might walk away a little bit, even underwhelmed is probably too strong a word, but feeling marginally less satisfied than you were expecting to feel.
Yeah.
I feel like that's sort of my feeling having finished this.
I think we both have had the same high expectations, something I usually lack, but I kind of was expecting a lot. And I found, especially when you talk about that blend of the narrative and the gameplay, that was the first problem that came up to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I bet you were the same. The dialogue was engaging to me. When the characters were talking, when things were being said, I wanted to listen, but I felt the gameplay puzzle itself involved more of my attention.
Yeah. So the basic way the narrative is delivered is every couple of missions, and when I say couple, sometimes it's 10 or 15 missions before you get a little bit of story content.
Sometimes that jump is quite large, and you can tell.
So you play a couple of these missions, and they're normally like 2 or 3 minutes long, a mission, at least in terms of how the clock ticks. If you die a lot, there's obviously a lot of respawning.
Yeah. But every mission is timed, by the way. And there's like the game has a leaderboard that you can see everyone's...
Yeah, and the top 15 people are all cheaters, so it's really just a pointless leaderboard system.
That's why I just tabbed over to Friends Only on Steam and just tried to beat your times.
Yeah, because I played this before you, and so my friends list was empty. So every couple of missions, you get a bit of story content, and this story content is pretty much just over-the-radio dialogue. So you've got Rob doing his top-down stealth missions.
Yep.
He's either talking to Alan or to Gisborne or to someone else who's, like, mocking him on the internet or something like that.
Usually people mocking him.
Yeah. And so even non-plot elements like that, where you hear about a competing streamer who's, like, dissing Rob, or you hear about a guy who thinks he's rad and so he wrote a rap about how cool Rob is. Even non-plot, just sort of like
world building
sort of like atmosphere, tone kind of dialogue interactions like that are still like 10 or 15 missions apart. So you really notice when it's not happening. When it does happen, like you say, it just plays over the top of a mission. And so what I would do is just stand still, let the dialogue sequence finish, then restart the mission and play it so I could get my timer from zero.
I didn't even realize you could play the mission at the start. I waited for the dialogue to finish for like the first 5 missions. I just stood there and listened.
And like John says, the dialogue is very well written. It's very engaging. Danny Wallace is just as compelling in this as he was in Thomas Was Alone. He's a very talented voice actor. The guy who plays Rob is good, and I think he was cast for the type of his voice more so than his acting ability.
Charlie McDonald is a YouTube personality, so it's kind of the right person to play a streamer.
I think so, but I've never seen any of his content. Have you watched any of his videos?
No, I haven't myself.
Yeah, it's like science stuff, if I'm not wrong, right?
Yeah,
I imagine that's pretty scripted, yeah?
Yeah.
It's a different talent, I think, and I think you can tell that this voice acting in particular is not his forte. It's totally fine. It's totally serviceable. It's not on the level of Danny Wallace or the guy who plays Gisborne, by the way, who's Andy fucking Serkis.
Yeah, okay, David, but if you're going to compare people to Andy Serkis, like, what are we even doing? Right? I think Charlie does a good job. And I would say that...
Can we just revisit the fact that Andy Serkis is in this game just for a moment?
Andy Serkis is in this game.
The guy was in the Ape movies and the other Ape movie and The Lord of the Rings and Black Panther. That Andy Serkis is in this game.
Yes, Andy Serkis is in this game, David.
That's pretty cool.
Andy Serkis is very cool.
And he does a good job.
Andy Serkis does a great job. I just want to say, though, that the voice talent pretty much across the board in this game is better than a lot of, like, some mainstream shooters.
Oh, absolutely.
Out there. And it strikes me so much. And not only the voice acting, but the quality of the writing. This game made me laugh. Right? And not because I was cringing or I thought it was awkward. There were jokes in it that I found funny.
Yeah.
It blows my mind when a game has a joke in it.
And again, we come back to Danny Wallace on that. Like, he's got an incredibly good sense of comedic timing, and I think that part of the reason he came back is because his voice suits so well the writing style that's used in a lot of Biffle games. So it's very funny, but there is very little of it. For 100 missions, you probably get, 8 actual scenes of interaction?
You get more than that, but it's still like 12 or 15, and even then, the game has dialogue it just throws when you start missions or pause the menu or do kind of stuff like that. That's feels really repeatable. So
lot of the time when you grab some of the loot you're trying to get, Rob will like laugh, and that's cute because it's just endearing and you can hear laughter a lot of times before it gets grating. But one that really got on my nerves when he was said, "You're welcome, internets." That was when I heard a lot, and it's like...
Once you hear that 4 times, it's 4 times too many.
It works maybe twice, that line. Maybe it works twice. And in 100 levels, I probably heard it 12 or 15 times.
And if you're only hearing interesting, engaging dialogue 12 or 13 times, but you're also hearing the line, "I did it for the internet," like, that many, that it kind of stands out. And I think that kind of unbalance in my mind.
The first time I heard a lot of that dynamic dialogue, I was really like, oh, wow, that feels very alive. And it reminds me that Rob is on this stream and he's performing for people. Like, I thought it was really good. It's just there's very little of it. And so it repeats quite a bit. And so the magic trick is lost very early.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a very small game. I don't want to be sitting here being like, why couldn't it be as dynamic as Shadow of Mordor?
Yeah.
You know? But I guess really the point we're making is the huge chasm between the narrative that we went in expecting this with and the narrative that we got, which is still very good, but it's not Thomas Was Alone. And I think there are two big things.
Yeah.
That kind of affect my experience of this game in ways, I don't want to say that they're unfair, but in ways that I think it's important to acknowledge. The first is that high expectations can make a good experience feel less good than it is sort of without those preconceptions. And the question needs to be asked if it's fair to compare this to a masterpiece like Thomas Was Alone. Is it fair to go into Jaws and walk out and saying, yeah, but it wasn't Schindler's List, though.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The other thing, too, and this is something we talk about a lot on this show, this game, I think, would have been much better for me if I was playing, like, 2 or 3 missions a day, but there are 100 missions and I had to finish it in a week. So I played, like, 15 to 25 missions each sitting. And that makes it feel a lot more repetitive than it would if I'd paced myself with it a bit more. And so I think playing it on a schedule like that, in fairness, did harm my perception of the game. And so, like, trying to cram in 25 missions into one sitting after an 8-hour day at work, it's not really the way this game's designed to be played. And normally, when we bring this topic up about whether or not playing to a schedule hurt my play of the game, it's actually, most of the time, it's the opposite. I feel like playing a game to a schedule motivates me to keep on to it and to have that momentum and that investment in it and to not be leaving 3 weeks between play sessions that mean I get lost. I'm like, oh, wait, what happened most recently? A game like this, I don't think is meant to be crammed into a period this short.
Yeah.
And I would have... I might not have finished it if I paced it out, but I think I would have enjoyed what I did play a bit more than having made myself get to the end of it for this show.
I mean, it just leads into the way the game is structured. It has these hard menu breaks between each level because it's going from mission to mission to mission, and there's 100 of them.
Mm.
It doesn't surprise me that you think that, because I kind of agree with you. It's definitely a game to dip into here and there and not cram. Mm.
And I think it's available on Vita as well, so like being able to play it portably would be really nice too.
Yeah, yeah. If you can go to a cave somewhere and find the Vita in stone, you know, you can, like, or you're an archaeologist,
yeah,
or something.
If you can Lara Croft your way into a tomb and pull it off the pedestal, put a bag of sand where it was.
You know, if you go to like a storage place, you know, that hasn't been opened for like 10 years, you'll find one out there.
Yeah, if you find the machine from Primer and can go back to like 2012... Yeah.
I've forgotten what Primer is.
Primer is a movie about time travel.
Oh, cool. Well, Time Machine then.
I'd said the machine from Primer and take you back to 2012. And what was clever about that is it led on from a storage facility joke that you made.
Is that what happens in Primer?
There's storage facilities feature prominently in Primer.
Okay, cool. But enough about terrible jokes that I ruined. Going into your first question about comparing a director's masterpiece to his other oeuvre, that could totally be a thing that happens all the time in my mind.
Yeah, but the thing is it fair to our assessment of a game as on its own merits? Because it sounds so biased, for want of a better word, to be like, we didn't like this game, but it's definitely good, and we want everybody to know that it's good, even though we didn't actually like it that much. I'm worried I sound like a DC fanboy, you know?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, but there's all of these other reasons why people didn't like Man of Steel. Man of Steel was actually a really good movie. You know, I'm worried I sound a bit like that, but honestly, this game on its own merits is very solid, yeah, especially for the context of it. And that's why I asked that question. If Thomas Was Alone hadn't existed, would I have gone into it expecting something like Thomas Was Alone? And I feel like I really want to make this part of it explicit as well. Thomas Was Alone is probably in my top 5 indie games.
Yeah.
Like, it is amazingly good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, you know, we're comparing Mass Effect 2 to Mass Effect 3, where it's almost like a more on par comparison.
Yeah.
We're talking about one of the best things that I have played.
Yeah, that you've experienced. It's hard to picture anything in isolation, especially when it's something matters to you so much, when it's so pivotal to how you think about the medium that you're experiencing.
Mm.
But when I look at the elements of volume, I do think that they are of pretty good quality. The only thing for me is puzzle games, because to me, a stealth game is a puzzle, right?
Yeah, and I would say of this game, especially so. Like,
yes,
there are parts that are really really puzzle-like. Mm-hmm.
There's a certain energy. I can only spend so much time solving puzzles before I start to get tired. And I did find the puzzles refreshing, and I did feel clever for completing them. There's that thing that when you solve a puzzle, but it's just like, oh, that was it. Oh, I didn't. Oh, I guess I just flunked my way through it. It feels unsatisfying. I felt like solving the puzzles was satisfying, and I felt like everything everyone said was exciting.
Yeah, and I think maybe we should talk about the actual gameplay elements that contribute to that. So there's a lot of things about the puzzles that are satisfying to complete, and I think one of the biggest elements of that is the equipment that you get.
Yeah.
So you've got your basic stealth, duck behind low walls so you can stand up behind high walls, avoid vision cones, try not to make too much noise, that kind of thing.
So far, so stealth.
Then you have the equipment in the game, and once again, this is all... It's almost... abstract the equipment because it's all in this low poly environment and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But you have different kinds of noisemakers, different kind of equipment that might make you invisible. But the actual use of the item is satisfying just from a usability perspective. So the first one you get is the bugle, and it is basically an orb of light that you throw, and it can bounce off walls, and then you can trigger it to make a sound further away from you. And so it takes the very basic throw a rock to distract a guard and turns it into almost a game, not a game of Pong, but you know what I'm getting at, yeah, like this geometric puzzle where you've got to bounce it off a couple of walls and get it in the right spot so the guard turns the right direction and
at the right time. Yeah. Yes. I think the thing that takes the next step is not only do you have to solve the puzzle in your mind, but executing it as well is part of that puzzle. When to trigger that, when to get the guard to turn around, how many guards you can pull away.
Yeah, and there's something about the fact that this particular thing bounces or that the ood is one that you place and then set off later that is almost like a remote mine almost. These things feel like you're not just outsmarting the guards, but you're almost outsmarting the system. Like it's almost like a cheat code in some ways. It felt like to me that you're manipulating the environment in a way that kind of only works in a digital environment. And so it's satisfying, not just as you say, in terms of that execution, but the presentation of it felt very satisfying as well.
Yeah. And there's a whole range of gadgets that you unlock. And to me, the interesting thing was the situations where it would sometimes give you more than one and that
you could choose which one you wanted to use to solve that particular level.
And that's something I like in a puzzle game because there are some sliding block kind of puzzles that have one outcome and one way of solving them.
Mm.
But because you can kind of work the edges a little bit in this environment that's set up, you can kind of navigate in slightly different ways. And so there's...
Yeah, and there are a lot of levels that use this premise of... So to complete a level, you've got to collect all of these floating gems that represent the valuables that are stored in this noble person's house or this general's barracks or whatever. And once you've collected them all, then you can go to the exit and leave. A lot of the levels, especially when they're introducing new equipment, you start at one end, you navigate through to get all the gems, and then you get to the end of the level where you pick up a piece of equipment, and that allows you to navigate back, which wouldn't otherwise be possible based on the patrols of the guards.
Yeah.
And so, like you say, it's about this execution. It makes you feel a little bit like a ninja, a bit, like because a lot of it is a little bit reflex-based, but then it has almost like a level-up quality to it where, okay, I have this new ability that lets me Metroidvania my way back. I can go through this gap where two guards were, where I couldn't get through before and that kind of thing. It really frees your movement. And like I said, it really gives you this sense of outsmarting the situation.
And not only is it built towards speedrunning, then because there's a level editor and an online community sort of interface, you can then play new levels and share levels. So not only is there... It has that kind of daily, weekly kind of puzzle feel to it.
Yeah, it's got like a staff picks thing as well, where the best community-created content is put forward by the staff members of the game, and so it's curated to some extent. One of the things I thought was interesting that I read after the game is this level creation thing was partly inspired by Metal Gear Solid 2, because there's apparently like a story of how Hideo Kojima prototyped the levels of Metal Gear Solid 2 using Lego blocks and just like plonking them down and getting a feel for how the world would look. And so that's where the inspiration for the level editor came, where you can just drop in these very modular pieces and create or modify existing maps.
And the game is well set up to have that kind of creativity applied to it because it's made up of just a set of tools of different enemies with different routes that you can set. It's just fun. you know, I'm not super excited by it, but I feel like it resolves itself competently, and I did enjoy it.
Yeah, and it sounds so underwhelming to say it in that way. Oh, it's a competent execution. Like, it is stealth mechanics that we've seen before, but there are still interesting elements to talk about with that. Because you hear things like, you know, you have a very low poly block environment where you can clip it together and make your own levels. You might be thinking of something quite dull, but the general aesthetic is compelling enough and interesting enough that not only does it forgive a lot of the lack of fidelity in the game as a whole, they are still able to do things in there that feel more expressive. And so when you go to different levels, they choose different color schemes. So if you go to a bank, it's got like these rich purples, or a museum had like, they have these like really rich colors, but then you might go to a science facility and it's all like blues and whites.
Yeah.
And there are some models that they do put in the environment, like chairs or desks or computers and that kind of thing. And that does give the room a little bit more life. And whenever Alan, your AI, has trouble rendering the environment, there are little quips he makes about where bugs are and how they're going wrong, and it still has quite a lot of character for something that sounds so rote when we try and describe it mechanically.
Yeah, and then you mentioned also, like, this is all taking place in like a warehouse, and so as you approach the edges of the map, you can see Rob's desk with his computer set up and his couch and a lamp and like all of the space around you. So it gives it this, I don't know what the feeling is to describe it, but it feels like homey. You're doing this in like a safe space.
Yeah, secluded, I think, yeah, is a good word for it. All of the real world is in shadow, but not like dangerous shadow, almost a nice house at night kind of shadow. It feels like you're in your home base and you're protected, although the narrative is run by this ticking clock where you know that eventually Gisborne's going to find you. He's going to trace the signal and all that kind of stuff, but you have to survive in the meantime and get as much of these plans out there as you can.
And I do love how it has that stealth game kind of soundtrack where it's very quiet during like the menu and the main sort of game, but then the second you get seen, it's like the orchestra comes out of nowhere and just starts playing.
Yeah, we should talk about the music actually, because, you know, the game is called Volume. It is a big part of it. So we mentioned that the same composer came back for Thomas Was Alone, and this is another element of it where, I mean, Thomas Was Alone is a masterpiece and this is very good, but it's not that. And so my first thing that I notice is, oh, this isn't Thomas Was Alone. The music is good, but once again, we're talking about a game with 100 levels in it. And I honestly think that if the game was like 65 levels for the main story, it would be a lot more satisfying, because you hear the music and it'll change occasionally, but it sort of changes in stretches of levels. So a series of levels will all have the same track. And I felt myself getting kind of tired hearing the same track over and over again. But when it changed, it was actually really good music when I got a new piece. But once again, the repetition of it, I think, hindered my enjoyment of it in total.
Yeah, I have to be honest, about halfway through, I felt done. Like, I had enough.
Yeah.
I was like, I would love to end now.
Yeah, I would like to get to the end of the story, please.
Yeah, and I just started playing from then on to just wrap it up, because I'd seen the beautiful aesthetic, I'd heard the wonderful conversations, and I'd listened to that music. But then I think that's the problem, is there's these moments where you feel like you're repeating yourself.
Yeah.
And because the aesthetic style, while striking and distinct, it can blend together a bit.
Yeah, because eventually you do get to the point where it's like, okay, I've seen red and white before.
Yeah,
I've seen red and white for at least sort of 10 levels. And so when you're the first time you see that purple and gold, you're like, whoa. But after you've seen purple and gold, you know, 8 or 9 times, it does kind of blend together a little bit.
You know, and all the objects get reused and kind of repeated. Mm. And it kind of runs up against that for me. You know, there's some people who really love puzzles and solving puzzles.
Yeah.
And I feel like this game really leans towards people who'd find that super satisfying. But just at some point, I was just struck by how it was like I was going through a crossword book.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Some parts of this, I think, like I said, would have been improved by me if I spaced it out a little bit more. The music, I think, is definitely not one of them. I think spacing that out would have made the music more obviously repetitive, because I would have been hearing the same music over a longer span of real-world time. It is well composed, but there are just a couple of pieces that again, if you want to compare this to something like Thomas Was Alone, you have a lot of electronic kind of beeps and bloops that are quite light and inviting, and the music takes you on this very long emotional journey. The music in this felt more practically designed. Yeah. Like you say, you've got these quiet parts and then these loud parts. And there are parts of it where you've got like choir, like a choir giving you that grand, like, oh, it's so epic and there's a struggle. And it just, it didn't quite...
You know what it
work?
Is?
It felt a little bit more cliched. And
it feels like music someone would put underneath their stream, because it's like, I don't know if it's cheapness or something to it, but it kind of feels like overused.
I think that's the biggest problem with it, is that it does feel overused. But even when you're in that main menu, I was kind of surprised at the tone that the music took the first time I booted the game.
I had a full freak out. Because I turned my volume down, I muted it. I could still hear that music. It felt so loud.
This is a criticism I read a couple of places before I even played the game. The mixing of it is a little bit off. Even when the music is quiet, it's still pretty loud. And when the music gets loud, it gets really loud. And
I'm not joking. I had it on zero and I could still hear the music.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even understand how that works.
And that sudden ramp up in intensity, I think, works a couple of times. If you're making a game like an Uncharted game and you have a scripted moment where the music suddenly just goes bang and you're like, this is it, action is on now, that works. If you have a stealth game where you hear that a couple of times throughout the game, that kind of works. When it's happening 8 or 9 times, like, some of these levels are quite hard.
Yeah.
And like, sometimes getting spotted is part of the solution too, so you're forced to trigger it. And so in some of these levels, it was rare I completed a level on my first run. Most of the time, I would take at least 2 or 3 attempts to get it. So in a 3 or 4 minute span, I'm going from quiet to bang to quiet to bang. And there are 100 levels in this. So I probably heard that transition 500 times.
And the music that's involved in that higher transition, it feels even more samey than the regular music to me.
Yeah. When you have the quiet music, you can really hear the difference when it changes. When they go bang, they obviously are intenser versions of that quiet music for that particular level. But you are right. The loud ones feel more similar to the other loud ones, and the quiet ones feel to the other quiet ones.
Yeah, it's like the tone of it. Because they hit this high beat, it just becomes the same sound in your head.
Mm.
And to me, that's almost more punishing than having to repeat it, was to constantly have the music blare at me every time I made a mistake.
Yeah, there was a little bit of fatigue with the louder music. And again, maybe that would be not so intense if it was paced out, but I honestly feel like that one probably wouldn't have made much of a difference.
Yeah, and it was interesting. They have a lot of, I mean, and I like this, even though it's the game's about speedrunning the levels and it gives you that time, it gives you reset points within a level, so you don't have to go all the way back, which I liked.
Yeah, there were a couple of, and you know, this is where we talk again about how it is a very puzzle-based stealth game. There are points where, like, okay, there are 2 guards here. I need to whistle to get one guy to walk here, and then I need to use blackjack on this guy, but I have to do that at the right time so that this guy won't see me using the blackjack, and I have to go around, and then I have to hide in the shadows for a bit so that he can return from his patrol. And stuff like that takes a number of attempts, and so I'm really grateful they had quite intelligent checkpoints.
Hotline Miami, this ain't, right?
You can't just bash your head against it.
Yeah, and while there is a certain freeform element to it, you still have to be considered in what you do.
It's interesting that you brought Hotline Miami up, because I think that a lot of people really like Hotline Miami. I wasn't a huge fan, and I think that the same reasons of why, because in this case it's more sound based, but both Hotline Miami and this engage sensorily with you. They are about engaging your visual senses and your auditory senses. You know, it's synth pop with that really neon kind of theme for that. And so I found myself getting quite fatigued playing that game, and even one level, the number of times it takes you to reattempt it, is draining if you don't take appropriate breaks. And I think that Volume has a similar thing. In both of those games, I kind of pushed myself to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly think that if I'd played about halfway through and said, yeah, that was pretty good, and then walked away, that would have been a more intelligent way for me to play the game as far as like what I got out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's a rush to it, but
that don't think either of the games really require you to finish them. You know, there is a plot ending to this, which we should talk about a little bit, but it's primarily about solving the puzzles and doing the stealth, you know, and getting the occasional bit of witty dialogue where you get to hear Jim Sterling say that Rob Loxley is a cheap charlatan.
Yeah, he was in this game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
not his best performance.
No, not really. I know he's playing basically himself, but like, I don't know. I'm fine.
Yeah, it's a really obvious cameo, and thankfully they only did it once, but it's also, again, when it comes to the mixing, I didn't mention this, all of the voices are really fucking quiet for some reason, and so even against the background of the regular music, I often found myself like, okay, shit, here's a dialogue sequence. I had to lean over and turn my speakers up so I could hear them at all.
Oh, this is the thing I do with all games. I go into the sound menu, I turn everything else down, and I turn voices up on almost every game I play.
I don't, but I wish I had for this. Yeah. It was bizarrely quiet compared to even the baseline music.
Yeah. When I got into that Phantom Ghost menu at the start where it wouldn't stop playing the loud orchestral music no matter what I did with my volume sensors, that's when I turned the... I was like, I need to change these volumes settings because it's going to be bad.
We should talk about the plot a little bit and some of the themes that the game goes for.
Sure.
So we should drop the spoiler gate as well. Mm-hmm. There's not too much to spoil in this, but it does have a plot that progresses. So if you want to play it spoiler free, thank you for joining us. So the basic way the plot progresses is Rob's doing his thing. Alan is conflicted because he is programmed to help Gisborne, but he has to obey Rob. And you know, sort of over the course of the game starts to say, hey, you know what, Rob, I've been looking at the internet and I think that you are right. These rich murderers are jerks.
Also, I have these weird new tastes and desires.
So he goes through that, and at about, I don't know, 80% of the way through the game, maybe a little bit earlier, you get one of the very few actual cutscenes where Gisborne projects himself into the volume and says, hey, guess what? Bunch of people have been following your footsteps and getting shot. People are dying, and some of them are killing my friends and my allies. This isn't just a game. And so Rob has this a little bit of a crisis of conscience here. Alan has to follow his orders. Again, Alan is the AI that runs the volume.
Yes.
Alan technically has to follow his orders, but Alan chooses to turn off the stream, and he says to Rob, I have to obey you if you tell me to turn this back on, but please don't tell me to do that. And Rob doesn't tell him to turn it back on, but keeps doing the stealth puzzles for himself, basically. Yeah. Towards the end of the game, they start talking a little bit more about the complexities of the situation they're in, and Rob comes to the realization, well, it's not quite as simple as we're the little guys and we need to rise up. We can just steal from the bad guys and that'll be great. There's not going to be any violence. Everything's going to be clean and easy. Revolutions aren't messy and dangerous and unpleasant.
Bloodless revolutions, totally a thing.
And one of the big themes, or the kind of the metaphors they use for that, is this whole digital versus analog, because Rob is in this digital space, and he and Alan have a pretty explicit discussion about this, where Alan's like, it isn't a digital solution. It isn't poor, good, rich, bad, steal, good.
It's not binary.
It's not binary. And then Rob comes to the conclusion, you know, I'm going to keep doing this until I figure out an analog solution. So there's a couple of things that work about this and a couple of things that don't, I think. Ultimately, the story does still come down on the side of Rob being motivated to do good, but there is a big chunk of it where they're basically saying, you know, it isn't quite as black and white as all this. But so, I mean, also, I'm going to make it very clear here. I think that rich autocratic fascist assholes are the bad guys. They are bad.
Especially when they have a coup and overthrow the government.
Yeah.
A system where you're born determines what you do.
And it's all super, super, super explicitly bad. And so it's very weird that for a big chunk of the game, two of the main cast are really conflicted about what they're doing, because they're still definitely the good guys.
Yeah, I think the conflict comes from like a naivety in thinking that they're absolved from guilt or dirt or blood.
Yeah, and right? I think that, so it's saying a little bit about political action and about protest and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's almost saying as much about streamer and YouTube culture. And I think that one of the messages I took from this is this idea that, like you say, that there's no blood on their hands, or that they can be guiltless, or that they can be removed from the situation. There's a bit of that idea in the attitudes of some popular streamers, that they're kind of removed from politics and they're kind of removed, like their actions don't really have consequences.
I just make videos on YouTube. I have no effect on the world around me.
Yeah, and they don't take responsibility for the actions of their community. And I mean, we talked about this in a recent Fastcast where Twitch is changing some of their community guidelines to help make it clear that, yes, you are in fact responsible for the actions of your community to some extent. And so,
especially when you tell them to do things.
Yeah, especially when you tell them to, like, harass people and shit like that.
Probably should be held accountable.
So I think that that's kind of more the angle that this game is examining it from, that it's more about Rob realizing that his actions and his audience have a consequence that he needs to feel responsible for.
Yeah.
And the basic way the game ends is that Gisborne's guys show up, Alan basically takes the bullet for Rob, and then Rob disappears, and it's implied that he's going to join the actual real world revolution and really start to do something and get his own hands dirty and take part in that. So the final message is that, well, actually, in fact, Rob was on the right side. He just needs to be more realistic about the consequences of what he's doing.
Which is something I can understand.
Yeah, and I think that that is a solid message. Mm. But for the 15 or so missions before that conclusion is reached, it does really feel like, does Rob think that he's the bad guy now? Are we supposed to think that Rob is the bad guy now? Are we supposed to think that these people who are basically slaves, and in many cases literally slaves, are wrong for wanting to overthrow the system?
Yeah, that's,
you know,
a good
it's like
point.
There's a chunk of the story there where it does get a little bit muddy, and because the story comes in such distant points of narrative delivery, you're stuck with that feeling for a while. It's not so much a problem with the themes of the game as it is with the presentation of the story, I think.
It could be that kind of thing where if they are trying to tell like a analogy for streamer culture and all that kind of stuff, when you focus on telling one message, the literal message that's in front of you gets muddied and mixed around.
Yeah, and that can be a little bit difficult for any game that examines multiple things at once.
Or any media that examines multiple things.
I will say, spoilers for Subsurface Circular here, but it had an incredibly binary ending, and I was dissatisfied with the nuance and the complexity of the solutions presented to you in that. I don't think the game was trying to present either solution as perfect. It was trying...
I think, in fact, it intentionally didn't.
Yeah, and I think part of it is aware of the fact that both solutions are very flawed for a number of reasons.
Not only that, but it gives you several options to change your mind.
Yeah.
And then it lets you choose, gives you more information, and then asks you again.
Yeah. So the final message in Volume, I think, is better presented than Subsurface Circular, but when you compare that to, again, something like Thomas Was Alone, the delivery of that narrative is not as consistent, and it does leave you questioning what the story's trying to tell you, and not in a think for yourself kind of way, more of in a hang on, have I missed something here kind of way.
Is the game going to end with us joining the bad guys?
Like, yeah, is Gisborne going to turn out to be right the whole time because he needed to control us from our savage urges or something?
Yes, you should all be my slaves. Oh, no.
Oh, thank you.
Gross.
One other thing we might want to mention is the game is very specifically English for a number of reasons.
Because the Queen's there!
Yeah, I mean, they talk about the monarchy, and they talk about, like, and when I say English...
Traditionalism.
Yeah, when we say English, I don't mean British, I mean English. Like, they cut themselves off from Scotland and Wales and Ireland and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's a part where they mention the EBC, and you're like, what? Oh, right, because it's England, not Britain.
Yeah. That comes through in a couple of the little vignettes that you get. Like, the guy who comes in and does the rap, I think the genre is like Brit hop, but it's a very much like a lower class kind of London voice.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of little things like that, a lot of Britishisms in the language, a lot of pride in England as like a motivating factor for Gisborne. And
I think tradition comes up as well. The idea of a history, having a history of a place too.
And they talk about like it's a very whitewashed history and that. They mention a lot of that kind of stuff, like the sanitation of England's past and calling to national pride. And there's stuff about immigration analogues, because this does take place in the same universe as Thomas Was Alone in Volume and Subsurface Circular, where AIs are like the new foreign group that's going to replace all, they're going to take all our jobs and that
kind
of stuff.
What was it? You know, they can reproduce in the billionth of an eye, they don't eat or sleep. Like, they're the worst.
And this is where any sci-fi analog for racism, we need to be careful with it, because you have, when it comes to things like AI, considering the fact that they don't sleep and don't need food and can replicate in nanoseconds, are actual real concerns rather than made up reasons for white people to be racist to not white people. Mm. You know, and so, I mean, we talked about like, in fantasy, you've got orc racism.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I mean, orc racism is not a great analog, because in these fantasy environments, the orcs actually were created by the Dark Lord to really do evil.
And
so saying that, like, it's just like black people is super not cool.
It's not at all.
Yeah.
It's a bad analogy.
And so, like, talking about the AIs are kind of an analog for Asian and South Asian immigrants in the UK. It's like, That's very not that, though.
Could sci-fi just use racism? Like, yeah, to be racism?
Because let's be real. It doesn't matter if the fucking Turians show up and blow a bunch of us out of the sky. We're still going to have really shitty attitudes towards people of different skin color for a long time.
Yeah.
Aliens showing up is not going to fix human racism.
No, no.
It's way more complicated than that.
Yeah, because half of it doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, where do we want to finish?
Where do we want to finish? When I think about volume, I finish on, I enjoyed myself. I like Mike Bithell's games. I think this stands with his other games. It just stands a little bit further behind.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty concise way to put it. It's a good game. It's different from what I get from his other games.
Yeah.
And I think that if I had have had a more gameplay expectation from it, or if I hadn't been expecting quite so much from the narrative, I mean, we've just talked quite a lot about the themes in it. There's still substance there.
Yeah, yeah. And we mentioned before that the voice acting and the writing that is there is fantastic.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And so there really is a lot to like, but I think that to enjoy the play experience of it, you need to know what it is and expect what it's good at and not expect it to be something that it's not.
Yeah, if you didn't like Thomas Was Alone or Subsurface Circular because one was too wordy and the other one was a bunch of blocks, who cares about blocks? Blocks are weird.
You're entitled to your wrong opinion, but volume might be for you.
Yeah, and it's fantastic to see everything else kind of be there and be on par. Even in a completely new, you know, 3D environment, like a genre switch, you know, it's a stealth game. It's a full 3D stealth game.
Yeah, and this sounds a bit like a justification, but it's also worth remembering that this is an indie developer and an indie studio, and seeing them develop from game to game is very satisfying, if for no other reason than like a almost like a documentary standpoint, you know what I'm trying to say? Like an interest standpoint in this studio and how they're developing the kinds of different games that they make. It's easy to kind of say, oh, well, the pacing wasn't great. Yeah, it was like a budget of £30,000 or something. Like, that's, I mean, fucking Braid had budgets in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. But, like, I would still buy the DVD and put it on my shelf. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad I've played part of his collection as well.
That's really what I'm getting at, that, like, there was a fast cast that I think it would have been a couple of weeks ago when this comes out that we talked about how long you need to play a game for before it gets satisfying.
Mm, mm.
And I think one of the things I probably said about that was that, you know, when someone says, oh, you've got to play a game for 15 hours, like I can play Thomas Was Alone and Firewatch and Journey 8 times in that amount of time.
Yeah. I think smartphone games have proven that people can play anything for thousands of hours.
And what I'm really getting at there is when I say things like, oh, you know, it's just a $30,000 budget, that doesn't matter to the average person who plays a game. What matters is what they personally spend on a financial level and an emotional level and what they get out of it.
Yeah.
And so when I say it's a small budget game, don't expect it to be X, Y, or Z. There is a truth to that, but really, on the whole, how much a game costs to make is very irrelevant to what you get out of it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that I like to be aware of, but like I said, it's not a bulletproof justification for, I just walked away with a B+ on this one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, okay. But I think that's our opinions on volume. It's a bit all over the place because we kind of had these expectations and stuff like that. And it'll be interesting to see if Mike Bithell makes a game that is terrible and what that would be like. Because we all make things that are terrible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like the ending of this podcast.
Well, look, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. If you want to get in touch with us and tell us about your thoughts on this game or ask us any questions for an upcoming Fastcast, you can hit us up on Twitter at SlowpokesCast or Facebook at facebook.com/SlowpokesPodcast. John, tell the viewers about our next game.
Our next game is going to be Metro 2033.
So, more than any other game on the podcast list, I don't want to do this one.
Wow, even more than all the spooky ones?
I mean, the spooky ones are going to be spooky, but I think that, like, I'm really going to grow and get something out of them. I've tried to play Metro 2033 a couple of times, played about 10 minutes of it, walked away and didn't pick it back up again, because it's depressing.
Yeah.
Almost by definition, it is depressing.
Oh, boy, it is.
But this is, like, one of your favorite games, right?
There was a brief period in my life that still continues to this day, and that existed for most of my life.
There was a brief...
life.
20 year period in my life.
20 plus, where I was obsessed with Eastern European video games about, like, Stalker is a perfect example, Shadow of Chernobyl.
Mm. Another game that I played for about 10 minutes and couldn't go back to because it was too depressing.
And we always talk about how, John started Mass Effect 1, like, 6 times and never finished it. I've played Metro and Stalker, like, multiple times. I had multiple run-throughs and played them a lot. I really enjoy these games. I even read the book for Metro 2033. I read a book, right? I should read more books.
But yeah, Metro 2033, I know very little about it. I know it's got something to do with mutants. It's post-apocalyptic. You live in train stations.
Yeah, it's
you
live in the subway. Metro of Russia, yeah. Moscow.
But the one thing, every time I hear it, I'm like, oh, maybe I really should play that game again, is the core premise of the fact that the currency of the Metro 2033 world is bullets.
Yes.
So every time you fire a shot, it costs you something. And I think that's a really fascinating idea, and I'm really interested to see how that propagates through the game.
Yeah.
Like I said, the part of me that wants to have fun doing things is not looking forward to this, but the part of me that's like, I will finally be able to look back on this game and discuss it and really understand what resonated about this with a lot of people, that's very excited to play it. Yeah. So I think that if nothing else, it's going to be a pretty interesting conversation.
Definitely. Yeah, there's lots of gameplay elements to it there that'll be really fun to talk about. And then the ending as well will be interesting because it's a wonderful game. Put together really well.
Okay, I didn't know it had an ending.
Yep, it does. It is a piece of media. All media ends.
What I mean to say is I didn't know it had a noteworthy ending.
Yep, I probably shouldn't have said anything, but now I have, and this is real life, so I can't unedit it.
Yeah, damn it, I'm going to remember that forever. Thanks, John.
You're welcome, David.
Well, that is it from us here at The Slowpokes. I have been David.
I have been John.
Thank you so much for joining us.